Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us now is our roundtable to discuss the week in Washington and beyond. Joining us is former Pentagon comptroller Bob Hale, who is, among his many hats, an adjunct senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. His views are his own. Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, and former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who also wears many hats, including as a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Gentlemen, thanks very, very much for joining us. And Bob, welcome back. It's a pleasure having you back on.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Vago.
Great to be back, Vago.
Glad to be back.
An absolute pleasure having you guys back on, especially two august comptrollers as we talk about what this infrastructure measure the president wants going to mean from a defense standpoint. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And we also want to welcome aboard General Motors Defense as our new technology coverage sponsor. Unemployment is falling. Vaccinations are on the rise. Many Americans are beginning to see light at the end of the long COVID tunnel. But the overall death toll is north of 553,000 as worries mount that there's going to be another deadly fourth wave that includes perhaps more virulent strains of the virus. President Biden has unveiled his first $2.2 trillion part of his two-part $4 trillion National Infrastructure and Technology Investment Plan, $650 billion for new roads and bridges, $80 billion for rail. No big surprise that given the president's affinity for Amtrak, as well as investments in, you know, military construction or military-related construction, artificial intelligence, quantum computing, 5G, cyber, the list goes on. At the Pentagon team is working hard on a budget that should already have been unveiled, or at least revealed on a top-line basis, right? We're still waiting for that. And elsewhere in the world, Russian tanks are massing on Ukraine's border. Israel has had another election. Jair Bolsonaro fired his defense minister. Let's start with on Capitol Hill. Michael, welcome back. Start us off. First, what are you hearing in terms of the top-line figures? We have been discussing on this program for some time, 704 to 708, when it comes to the defense part of it, 738 is the overall number. This has been moving a little more slowly. So folks think that there are some real cuts that are happening, in part because the last administration had put a very ambitious budget increase goal, right? So at the very beginning, you're starting from a position of cutting. And what, right, there were three reconciliation packages. The stimulus was the first one, and then there were the two infrastructure measures. So reconciliation two is this $2.2 trillion package. Give us your budgetary sense and what this reconciliation two will mean for defense and aerospace.
Sure. Okay. So I'll start with the reconciliation and get into the budget. So, you know, as you correctly pointed out, it looks like there really could be two of these infrastructure packages. Now, the first plan, which the president has unveiled the outlines of, really focuses on repairing the nation's physical infrastructure, such as bridges, railways, ports, water systems, you know, the reviving domestic manufacturing, and investing in research and development and expanding clean energy investments, which would include, you know, creating a nationwide infrastructure for electric vehicles. The second package, which is expected to be unveiled later this month or maybe the following month, really will focus on things that include expanding childcare, paid family and medical leave, expansions of healthcare, free community college, universal pre-K. And it's important to note that both of these packages are partially paid for by a series of different types of taxes. And I think he's really bifurcating these packages because I think one has a better chance of success than the other, but both will be very difficult to pass. And I think there's this, you know, notion now they're going to try and work on a bipartisan basis, but I think they know full well that these things are not going to pass on a bipartisan basis. There's already talk of, as you mentioned, using the reconciliation vehicle, which is a way to pass these through majority vote where you don't have to worry about the filibuster to get these done. Now, it's also, you know, important to note that, you know, reconciliation is always believed to be used once every fiscal year. So they were able to use a reconciliation package earlier this year for the COVID relief, the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan, because there was no budget resolution passed in FY21. So now they can use the FY22 vehicle for this infrastructure plan. Now, the Democrats, however, have been looking at the Congressional Budget Act of 1974, and they think that they found a loophole there that can unlock a third reconciliation package. There's a section in that act, Section 304, that says that Congress may revisit and amend an already passed budget resolution like the one used to pass COVID relief. So this, again, will end up making the Senate parliamentarian the most most powerful person in the Senate, but there is a chance that they can unlock another reconciliation package. So that being said, I spoke with a senior senator, a Democratic senator, who's on a defense committee last week about this, about the package and also the taxes that fund part of it. And he even said to me, he said, look, I'm part of a group of senators, 10 Democrats, 10 Republicans. And when the conversation of taxes come up, the room gets very quiet. So I think even the Democrats will have a tough time passing this package with just Democratic votes in the House and the Senate. They can't afford to lose a single Democrat in the Senate, and they can only afford to lose four Democrats in the House. So that presents some serious challenges to them. But there are some big implications for defense here. In addition to the macro issue of the worry of adding to the debt, I mean, both these packages together would total $4 trillion. The taxes proposed are about $3 trillion if they're able to get all those done. So in the end, we're still adding $7 trillion to the deficit when you put all these packages together, which will put more pressure on defense spending going forward. But there is $180 billion in this infrastructure plan for new research and development spending, which is also intended to drive military innovation. There's been a lot of concern that the U.S. has been ceding its position as the world's top innovator to China over the years. I mean, for example, U.S. investment in basic R&D was 2% of GDP back in 1964, and now it's just 0.7%. So this package, will spend money on emerging technologies, funding for quantum computing, artificial intelligence, microelectronics, things like energy storage, separation of rare earth elements, which is used in many of our defense systems, and some money for bricks and mortar for research labs across the country. So this package, if passed, will have some serious implications on in a good way for defense. Now, to answer your other question about what I'm hearing on the top line, I'm hearing mixed things. I think a lot of people on the Hill do expect a flat budget. Now, what does flat really mean, right? I think flat is basically what you said. I think really 738 was the number in FY 20, 740 was the number in FY 21. I think that's what people are expecting. I hear from some people that it might be slightly above that, some that it might be slightly below that. And the rumor on the Hill is that the reason that the budget has been delayed, at least the skinny budget, which everybody expected yesterday, is because the number is lower than people expected and that the Pentagon is actually appealing its number to OMB. Now, there also has been a lot of talk too about when this budget comes out, that there's going to be a lot of green initiatives in the budget request, mandating electric vehicles, trucks, ships, aircraft, weaning them off of fossil fuels. And that's, an important thing because, the Republicans on the Hill have made it clear it's not just the top line number, it's what that money gets spent on. And when they talk about what that money gets spent on, they use these green technologies as an example. If the budget comes over flat and there's a lot of money put in there for things they consider the Green New Deal, the Republicans are not going to support the passage of an NDAA or a defense appropriations bill that includes these things. And the Democrats know they cannot pass an NDAA or defense appropriations bill without Republican votes with just a 5-seat majority.
I think what's interesting about the whole green or energy debate and discussion is it is a vulnerability, right? It's a national security vulnerability. And we took enormous numbers of casualties in Iraq, in Afghanistan, delivering fuel, right, to forward outposts and things like that. And so anything you can do to minimize or at least be able to get more, deliverable for the amount of energy you're putting into something, the better it would be, right? Having a whole bunch of ships that can go at 50 knots but burn through gas at enormous levels may not be as, maybe perfectly fine if you have a lot of gas stations nearby, somewhat more problematic if you're in the Western Pacific, for example, where the number of gas stations is fewer and farther between. So that's the problem I have with this, is that ultimately you're getting into a much, much better place than a much worse place. It's just going to be bad for some of the people who are involved in that ecosystem in the meantime. And obviously, that's one of the reasons the president is talking about retraining and figuring out you know, how do we at least give valuable and worthy work to people who are in these industries as we transition out of them? Bob, you were in the Pentagon the last time. Obviously, green was very important to the Obama administration when you were there as well. What's your sense on the top line and where we are on the top line now, and where we're going and some of the trade-offs necessary to try to get there? Because all, you know, there's a little bit of disappointment. There was an expectation that the administration would have had more appointees in at this point to be able to hit the ground running. Obviously, a lot of qualified people there as special assistants and actings, et cetera. Give us your sense on both of them and where we are.
Well, I am surprised, and I think it's unfortunate for the Pentagon that we don't have a top-line budget yet. They need it to plan, and perhaps they are appealing it. I think it'll end up close to flat also, but they need a number at this point. We're in April 2nd now. If they're going to try to get a budget by early May, they need to already be well along, and they certainly need a number so they can do this specific planning. So, I suspect if I was there, I'd say, just give me a number and let's get going so that we can move the process ahead. Vago, on the political appointees, I think it is a significant problem that we only have two in place and one other nominee for defense so far. A significant problem for two reasons. One, the lesser one, we've got people in place now in acting roles. Those are usually senior civil servants. They have important jobs of their own, which they can only partially do if they're also acting. But the more important problem is that acting, I was one for a while, your job is to keep the trains running on time and do no harm. You generally don't think of yourself as a change maker, and yet we need a change and adaptation to things like this infrastructure bill. I think defense could potentially benefit from it, and they need to be taking advantage of it. They need their political appointees in place in order to make that happen. So the lack of them, in my view, is serious, and I certainly hope we will soon hear some more intents to nominate for senior DOD people.
And what do you make of the infrastructure measure, right? Reconciliation 2 and the defense elements of this, right? I mean, because they're Elaine Luria, who joined us on the program a couple of weeks ago, the Democrat from the Tidewater area who represents Norfolk Naval Base, said, look, there should be an infrastructure component to this, right? The dry docks, for example, that the nation relies on, many of them date from World War I. And that infrastructure is the same across the board. You know, we've focused on housing, but not roofs on shipyards, for example, right? Which is affecting our ability to generate combat power from an ever smaller force that's going to have to deliver more. At the end of the day, what's your sense on whether the priorities that are in the measure as it's proposed now are the right ones? And, you know, if you were Secretary Hale sitting at the Pentagon where Secretary Austin is, what are the things you might want to add to that list?
Well, let's start with what's in the bill as proposed. And incidentally, I think Michael's point is well taken. It will be difficult to pass, but let's assume it's passed more or less as proposed. There are some potential significant advantages for DOD, I think, in this bill. Some of them are indirect. Michael mentioned that several hundred billion dollars of R&D spending. There's $50 billion of that for semiconductor research. Defense needs the kind of R&D improvements that could come out of this legislation because they depend so much on the private sector for technological innovation. So important indirect effects in that sense. And some that are more, I guess, prosaic is the right word. The infrastructure improvements, there could be indirect benefits there. Some of the bases that DOD has, the communities surrounding them have crumbling infrastructure that supports those bases. This bill would provide more money for drinking water, for electrical grids. And hopefully defense will be out there encouraging the communities that surround their bases to try to make use of that infrastructure funding. And there are some direct, potential direct effects for DOD. There's $10 billion in the bill as proposed for improving federal buildings. If I were Austin, I would certainly have my staff get together a wish list, because defense certainly has a number of buildings that could be improved. And maybe you could get some of the drinking water, the electrical grid money for actual use on the bases themselves, because DOD has some serious infrastructure problems on its bases, especially those who were built back in the 1950s. So if I were Austin, I think the first thing I'd do is try to use this bill as it's proposed, and assuming it gets passed, for my benefits before I started going to try to change it, which will probably be a challenge.
Dove, your sense on all of this, where we're going budgetarily, and I would note to our audience that you put out a great piece in The Hill, Reform the Pentagon's Budget Process or Lose Our Military and Tech Advantages, and I think you're spot on the mark on that. Talk to us a little bit about reprogramming flexibility, which has been the bane of every comptroller and Pentagon leadership in history. Give us your sense on all that.
First of all, I think Mike and my successor, Bob Hale, laid it out quite well. A couple of observations. First, I know that when we had trouble with OMB, and I think every comptroller does to a greater or lesser extent, Rumsfeld went to the president. I don't know that Austin will be able to have that same kind of clout with President Biden in order to get more money than OMB is willing to give him. So that's something to bear in mind right there. On political appointments, my experience was that a whole bunch of us, even before intention to nominate was publicized, were acting as consultants. And we basically worked with Rumsfeld to make all decisions. We just couldn't sign the papers. So that was a little bit of a mitigating effect to what Bob was talking about. What worries me is that by April, there were an awful lot of intentions to nominate out there. And if you don't have that, I wonder how many people are actually doing what we did, serving as consultants, knowing that our names were going to go to the Hill. That really is a problem, and I share Bob's concern about that. My point about reprogrammings is really quite straightforward. We've talked about the fact that there's a lot of indirect support for the Pentagon. But if you think about that R&D that's out there in the commercial sector, if, for instance, the Defense Innovation Unit wants to pick up something and then decides that that particular element that they've put some of this $180 billion into a small program, it's just not working out. And the program is worth, you know, a new program that they really want is worth more than, it costs more than $10 million. Well, guess what? They've got to go to four committees to get approval. That's crazy. That's absolutely nuts. $10 million on a $700 billion budget or on an over $100 billion R&D budget, it makes no sense. And to move monies around generally, you can't do more than $6 billion. And in the corporate world, you move monies around very, very quickly, sometimes on a daily basis. So if we're really going to get serious about using that R&D money, not just for the general welfare of the country, but specifically for defense, we've got to have a much more flexible approach to how we deal with it, because a lot of these programs, they don't start out as billion-dollar programs. They start out as small bucks programs, but small bucks can be more than 10 million. Why go to four committees to get approval for that? So what we're doing is we're shooting ourselves in the foot. If we want to really get ahead of the Chinese, we can't just, you know, talk about AI and all, and quantum and all of that and throw large sums of money at it. We have to think about execution. It's what every comptroller worries about, whether they're in the Defense Department or in any other company or anywhere.
I completely agree with you, Doug, but we're doing more than shooting ourselves in the foot. We're shooting ourselves in the head, because the fundamental disunity, not wearing masks, not doing all of this stuff, sends a worse message to the Chinese rather than what folks at the Pentagon are doing. I mean, at the end of the day, national will and an ability to get things done at a national level is what the Chinese are looking at. The fact that we keep tripping over our shoes and having pedantic sort of arguments, I think, does more to hurt us than anything else. You were saying, Bob.
So unfortunately, on the repro, first, I certainly agree with the DOD needs more flexibility. I'll give you one idea of how to do that in a moment. But on the reprogramming, unfortunately, we've moved in the opposite direction, that is toward less flexibility because of the disaster over the border wall and the fact that the reprogramming rules aren't in law, because if they were, they would be unconstitutional. It's an informal agreement with the Congress. The Trump administration decided to ignore that agreement and move money for the border wall. And Congress has responded by lowering the total amount of reprogramming. So far, no other restrictions that I'm aware of. So we've moved in the wrong direction. This administration needs to get back the trust of the Congress, because reprogramming is critical. One other thing Congress could do is to allow defense to budget in some broader categories, especially for technology initiatives, where they very much, as Dove suggested, need to move money around in execution to respond to changes in technology. Congress has been very reluctant to do that, but if I were the next comptroller, on my legacy list, things I wanted to get done would be to try to persuade them to at least give modest additional flexibility to R&D projects in particular, by budgeting in somewhat broader categories. It might be doable if you worked it hard and if Austin and other senior leaders got behind you.
I want to go to sort of the consistency of role in the Democratic Party, right? Trying to put labor back into the center of things. Biden is becoming even more popular with labor voters, although the Republican Party has made some enormous gains over that time. The Mark Econa move to try to cancel the ground-based strategic deterrent program and redirect money to COVID research, very much in the wheelhouse of what progressed. I mean, I think they would have been more honest if they had just said, we just don't want this nuclear program and make it go away, than something contrived. COVID research is certainly benefiting from an enormous amount of funding, and we do need to resuscitate the third leg of the triad, and the administration looks like they're on support the program as well as the leadership. But the Republicans are doing something that seems to be a potentially dangerous transformation of trying to redefine themselves as a working class party, and then being anti-corporate in a way that the, you know, because pro-corporate has been the core element of the Republican brand dating back to the 1930s. So, and earlier, what are the implications of this for defense, Michael? And start us off, right? Because you're at the front line as a lobbyist working some of these issues. What on earth does that mean?
Regarding the Markey Econa bill that you mentioned earlier, I mean, it caused a little bit of a stir to some companies outside the Beltway, but those inside the Beltway know that this bill has no chance of passing. You know, as you know, they introduced a bill to defund the GBSD and then send that money over into COVID relief. You know, they're not trying to abandon the triad in their bill. What the bill would establish a commission to extend the life of the Minuteman III, but this is a bill that really has no chance of going anywhere. So I think that the GBSD program is on safe ground. Just earlier this week, Jim Banks, who, as you know, is on the House Armed Services Committee and is a ranking member of a subcommittee, also chairs the Republican Study Committee. And he put together a six-page memo that was titled Cementing GOP as the Working Class Party. And he handed that to Kevin McCarthy earlier this week. And one of the key lines in the memo, it says that House Republicans can broaden our electorate, increase voter turnout, and take back the House by enthusiastically rebranding and reorienting as the party of the working class. You know, Banks argues that members should embrace their pariah status in corporate America and campaign against corporate fundraising. And I'll say on top of that, I've had some exchanges with some members in the Republican leadership who, you know, like the Banks memo, and they'll say to me that they are tired of being lectured by corporate boards and CEOs, are tired of being called racist, tired of feeling constrained. They're furious about the liberal agenda being forced down their throats. I'm kind of paraphrasing from an exchange I had with a member recently. And there's a backlash they feel that's about to come. It's going to be over the 18 months that this member described to me as epic. And they feel there's a tremendous amount of hypocrisy in corporate America. I mean, at least outside the defense industry, for example, with the companies that are criticizing these members of Congress, but at the same time doing business with China, a country that's operating concentration camps. But the implications for defense are serious, because if members do start to shun corporate money, It will weaken the influence of some of America's defense companies with members of the Hill and with members of their oversight committee.
I mean, having talked to some Republican friends as well, right? I mean, there's a frustration. It's like, well, so you guys were very happy to take the tax cuts we gave you and all the looser environmental regulations and everything else that benefited you and improved your bottom line. You were perfectly happy to accept those. And now, you know, you're kind of throwing all of this back at our faces, right? So I could see that certainly being something where, you know, if you were a member and you did do that, you'd be pretty hacked off given where we are now. Dove, your sense as a lifelong Republican?
Well, first of all, the corporations tend to be the kinds of Republicans that many members on the Hill would call rhinos. They represent the old line, sort of Northeast Republicans that are practically extinct. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that there's a real, I guess, push and pull for corporations because, yeah, they'll give money to members of Congress, but they're located in states. So if you're headquartered in California, you are subject to all kinds of these progressive things, and you can't speak out against them because it'll just make things worse. And look at what's been going on in Georgia. Look at the reaction to the corporations who at first kept their mouths shut and then realized that's not going to work. And so they, because of who they need to sell to, they realized they had to speak out in a way that they really didn't want to. Well, that's in a state that's sort of borderline now. I mean, it's purplish. Well, if you're located in a state that's not purplish, but really blue, you've got a problem. And so they're caught between, on the one hand, what the federal representatives would want out of them, got, you know, support what the Republicans are looking for and contribute to the backlash that the Republicans in Washington believe will come. But on the other hand, they've got to live with their state governments. And in blue states, they've got a problem. That, I think, is keeping a lot of CEOs up at night.
Bob, I'm glad we've got a very bipartisan panel here. For all intents and purposes, we're looking at Michael as the independent in this conversation, even though I should say, right, you ran for Congress as a Republican many years ago from the great state of New Jersey. I should point that out for our audience, the three people who don't know that.
Thank you.
Not at all. And by the way, I think you would have made a tremendous congressman, whether you were coming from the great state of New Jersey or anywhere else. Bob, how are Democrats going to navigate this, right? Because at the end of the day, you know, I've talked to friends of mine, independent friends of mine, whether they're left-leaning or whether they're right-leaning, and there is an enormous amount of frustration with, for example, the tax increase proposal. That they feel is unfairly going to hit small business owners that are, you know, and that actually the big companies that are getting away with not paying taxes will still get away with not paying taxes. What's the dynamic here in the consideration that the Democrats are going through? Because it seems like it's kind of a problematic calculation at the end of the day, right? I mean, do you want to really hit job creators who are simply, if they're going to pay more taxes to the government, are simply not going to hire as many people? Or is the assumption that a dramatic increase in federal spending is what's going to make up that difference, which I don't really think is healthy for the nation either. And I think most people would agree with that.
You've raised a lot of issues there. Let me just say, from an economic standpoint, it doesn't really matter whether you raise taxes and raise spending. They're going to have generally the same economic effects over the longer run. I think most economists would agree with that. How you raise them and what you spend on certainly could be important. But I mean, the Democrats need to put together a coalition to pass legislation. Biden has obviously, taken the lead in saying what he wants done and how he wants it done. And now I think they're going to have to try to get behind him, and they should try to get behind him. Otherwise, nothing will happen, and that can't be good for the Democratic Party. Let me just add, I think defense needs to be very careful in this debate. Obviously, there's a lot of partisanship, a lot of redefining of the parties, defense wants to stay out of the politics to the extent they can. You can never do it completely, but I still remember in 12 years of being a senior political appointee in the Department of Defense, I never, when I had some really good parking spots during that period, I never once saw a bumper sticker for any federal office holder, president or any or congressperson. I think defense has done a pretty good job of staying out of the politics, and they need to continue to do that again, to the extent they can.
I'm going to move on because time is running short, and I think we have to discuss Ukraine and Russia. Dov, why don't you start us off on that? You know, Russia has moved tanks to the Ukraine border, something which is raising tensions. Russia and China have been getting extremely close. So there are some who wonder whether or not there is some linkage, for example, with the China trade deal, for example, going sideways with the EU after the EU backed American sanctions against Chinese officials in Xinjiang. So this sense that Russia can, you know, hey, Russia, don't act up while we're doing this deal. Now that the deal is over with, go ahead and why don't you act up? There may be also, there are domestic political pressures on Putin as well. Navalny is a massive thorn in the in the Russian government side. What's your sense about what's going on? And more importantly, how the United States and its allies need to respond? Because this is clearly a test directed at NATO, at a distracted EU, and a United States that I dare say might also be somewhat distracted by domestic considerations.
Well, let's start with the fact that from an American perspective, the fact that, as you put it, the Chinese EU deal has gone sideways is a huge development. It is a real signal that the allies are starting to pull together in a way that they hadn't for the previous 4 years. So that's number one. It may well be that the Chinese and the Russians coordinated. After all said and done, look at the statements that came out of the two foreign ministers of the two countries right after the Anchorage meetings with Jake Sullivan and Tony Blinken. They were almost identical in attacking the United States and the West. Those two countries are probably closer together now than they've been since the Sino-Soviet split of the 1950s. They're not an alliance, but they sure are close to it. On the other hand, if you want to talk about the American reaction, I had written something about this last week, and I got an email from a senior serving military officer who said, oh yeah, I still have my big team against just those two. Well, just those two are two nuclear powers who are very, very aggressive, and our alliance isn't that tight yet. So Putin is testing us yet again. Just like the Chinese tried to test us at Anchorage, they didn't succeed. Well, Putin might. Let's see what we do for Ukraine. The Ukrainians are screaming loud. Obama never really helped them. Ironically, for all his kowtowing to Russia, Trump did send lethal weapons to the Ukrainians. Let's see how Europe supports the Ukrainians. Let's see what happens with the Nord Stream 2 deal that Germany is still going ahead with, the gas deal with Russia. There are a lot of options here. And it's true that Biden is somewhat preoccupied, maybe more than somewhat, with domestic issues. But it took a lot of thinking to determine how Blinken and Sullivan were going to respond to the Chinese. And I think China is a very, very important issue for this administration. And to the extent that the Chinese and Russians are working in tandem, that's got the administration's attention. So there are ways of doing this. There are ways of working with the Europeans to pressure the Russians even more. And of course, to pressure the Germans to at least rethink how far they want to go with Nord Stream 2.
I would, at the expense, because I want to avoid calls, I think the administration does have its eye on this, and they are focused on this from a strategic standpoint, is at least what they would say to this emerging situation. Michael, for lawmakers, there's tended to be sort of a binary way of looking at this, right? That it's important to, you know, and it was reflected a little bit in the Pacific pivot the Obama administration had. We need to worry a little bit less about Russia. let's worry more about China, focus more on China, focus more on the Middle East. Hey, Europeans, do more in Europe to counter or to deter Russia. And there was this sense that Russia is sort of a dying power, you know, weakening power, as opposed to still a country of 190 million people that can make things very uncomfortable. It is a great power. And it's a great power that increasingly, the more pressure we put on them, the more interest they have in working with Beijing, and the more pressure you put in on Beijing, Beijing is going to look for its own allies and partners. Among lawmakers, is there a sense of regarding, do they see Russia as and that China is the big game, or are they increasingly also going, you know, it's not just China, it's China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and pariah states together, and countries in the middle that will slide between two sides like they did during the Cold War, that is more the dynamic we need to be prepared for? Or what's lawmakers thinking on this?
I think it's really more of the latter. Look, China's been getting a lot of attention, especially during the pandemic and as we get out of the pandemic and the concern more over supply chain. But definitely a lot of concern from lawmakers from both parties on Russia. The Democrats love to remind the Republicans that Russia is not our friend. And I think you have most Republicans in agreement with that. I mean, I think you did see a few on the fringe lately, like Matt Gaetz coming out and, you know, defending Putin. But that's not where the mainstream Republicans are, just like the mainstream Democrats are not where AOC and Ilhan Omar are. So there's a lot of concern, too, that, you know, our allies in Europe are generally concerned about Russia and Russia's intention, and that we have pulled out not only troops, but most of our heavy armor has been pulled out of Europe over the last 2 decades.
Right.
So there's not much of a deterrent there. And obviously, Iran continues to be a major concern as we see the current administration trying to figure a way back into this Iran deal again. North Korea is a concern, and as well as the other pariah countries you mentioned. So, but that's also going to be used on the Hill as an argument for higher defense spending. So if a budget comes over that's insufficient, you're going to see Republicans latch on to why we need more, and not just Republicans. I mean, we've seen folks, you mentioned Elaine Lori was a guest on your show recently. I mean, she's been on record arguing for the 3-5% increases in defense that the defense strategy calls for. So, and I think you also see a lot of Democrats who won those Republican seats in 2018 and held them in 2020. I mean, a lot of those Democrats would have been Republicans back in the 80s. They are, you know, very moderate, very strong pro-national security, but just a little more social liberal. And many are veterans, you know, like people like Mikey Sherrill, Jason Crow, or folks like Andy Kim from New Jersey, who is a national security professional who worked in National Security Council, State Department, and the Defense Department. So I think you have a lot of folks that see the bigger problem that you laid out in the second part of your question.
Bob, what's your sense on all this?
Putting together defense budgets is a matter of weighing risk against how many dollars you have. If the budget's flat or maybe even going down slightly, the Department of Defense is going to have to decide where it takes risks. And that will eventually, I think, lead to some further force cuts. In the near term, in fiscal 22, I think what you're going to see is some substantial cuts in acquisition, particularly procurement. Because that's the only thing you can do quickly, and they have very little time. As they look over 5 years, I think they'll take a broader view. But it's a matter of weighing risks against dollars. And we are playing on the margin here. We're not fundamentally, if I'm taking 20% out of the defense budget, maybe you're taking one or two. I think there are probably some ways you can take those risks in a reasonable manner.
And I should say, right, none of this is new thinking, right? Cricket was the rule of thumb for the Obama administration, which meant China, Russia, Iran, Korea, terrorism. So, I mean, I think that there's this sense and this notion that the rogues will get together in order to oppose the United States is not anything new in foreign policy. We've got to wrap up the show. We've got about 30 or so seconds left. Dove gets the last word. I should point out to our audience, he had a tremendous piece also in The Hill last week that an anti-U.S. alliance is in the making, and Russia and China are moving ever closer together. But I want to get your take, Dove. Fourth Israeli election, so pretty much Benjamin Netanyahu is likely to stay prime minister as long as he wants to keep the office. And then the administration and Europeans moving a little bit closer to try to resuscitate the Iran nuclear deal, and Iran is having none of that. frankly, on the heels of their $400 billion trade deal with China, as well as a big trade deal with Russia. They may not need it anymore. Talk to us about Israel and what we should expect, if anything, which might be a shorter discussion than Iran.
Well, it's not clear Netanyahu is going to get in. The president of Israel clearly doesn't want him in, and he's the president is the one that decides whom he asks to form a government. Netanyahu, even with the party of Bennett, which is also a religious Zionist party, only gets 59 seats. He needs the Arabs to be part of, there's a new Arab party, the conservative Arab party. He needs that party to come in with him.
Which he has been trying to curry favor with in an extraordinary way that has both worked and not worked, right?
Exactly.
But I think it's interesting.
So, you know, the leader of that party is talking to both sides to get the best deal, which makes a lot of sense. So the game, it's not entirely clear that Netanyahu will come back. Of course, he's desperate to come back because he wants a law that'll exempt him from his whole trial and it looks like many people think conviction. That's the thing to watch. Can he pick off the Arab party? What does that do to some of the other crazy right-wing coalition partners that he seems to have? It's still up in the air. Regarding Iran, we just have to wait till the elections in Iran in June. Because at this point, nobody is going to make a move. The Ayatollah Khamenei is negative about this. As you say, the Iranians are shoring up their economic problems with China and to some extent Russia and India, by the way. And they just got another waiver from the Biden administration to be able to sell oil to Iraq. So they're not in as much trouble as perhaps they were 6 months ago. Once the June election is decided, it then becomes a question of, well, who wins? And is this going to be a hardline IRGC, Republican Guard kind of government that's anti? Or will they turn around and say, okay, let's keep talking, let's work something out? The Europeans, of course, are pushing very hard. They're having an informal meeting about this. The Biden administration has blessed the meeting. It's clear the Biden folks want to make a deal, but they don't want to make a deal that gives everything away before they get Iranian approval.
Guys, thanks very, very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Hope you guys have a great weekend, a great Easter. We extend that to our entire audience. And as a quick programming note, because of Easter Sunday, the business report will be available on Monday. But do check out our strategy conversation with Mike Petters on Saturday. Everybody, thanks very, very much for joining us. Have a great week and look forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.